Yeah. Good morning, friends. My name is Jay Stennett, and I'm an alcoholic. And love is doing for me today what I could not do for myself, because it's like, you know, going on 11 o'clock, Seaside, Oregon, and I haven't had anything to drink yet this morning. And that's a really big deal. So I came to you on the second day of May in 1979, and although I found it necessary on a lot of occasions, I haven't taken the front drink, sniffed any glue, or done any of those other things that I found to be so consoling. And so this is, you know, I've been invited to tell my story. This may not be your story, but I've been graced to be sober since my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. And there is, there is no hierarchy here. And before I launch off on my story, because this is going to, what I talk about today is about the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, not the personality of Jay Stennett. And it is my fervent desire that I impart to you that my job in Alcoholics Anonymous and working with others has allowed me to pass on a level of honesty and commitment which was maybe just a little bit more than what my sponsor had. And I pass that on to the guys that I sponsor. So they should be better members of Alcoholics Anonymous than I am. And the guys that they sponsor should be better members of Alcoholics Anonymous than, you know, say Bill is. And what happens is that what we have here is we have a spiritual evolution. More has been revealed. And we get to be heirs to that and to share it so that this incredible life-giving program can be transmitted more effectively today than it was when I came in 1979. Now, I was living in my Pinto. For the younger people here, that was a smart car that the Ford Motor Company manufactured for alcoholics back in the 70s. It was highly flammable, just like its occupant. And you know, that's not how I was raised to live. You know, I was born in El Segundo, California, which, if you need a reason to drink, is as good as any. On one side of the town is the Los Angeles International Airport. On the east side are the defense contractors. On the south side is the second oil refinery in the state of California, which is where the town got its name. And then on the little patch of beach between El Segundo and the Pacific Ocean is the waste treatment plant for the entire county of Los Angeles. So you just want to get right with your environment, right? So I was the short guy. I don't know if you remember the short guy in school. I can't throw the ball as far. I can't run as fast. But by the time I'm 12 years old, I find that I have a talent that exceeds people that are bigger and tougher and stronger than me. I can metabolize beverage alcohol. And when you're gifted, you got to go with it. You know, and, you know, by the time I'm 13, the last thing that I ever wanted to be, because my dad was a really good looking guy, and my mother was a really good looking gal, and the last thing I wanted to be was lame. And you know, my dad drank a bunch and he moves fast, and my mother didn't drink at all. So the violence in our home came from the unrecovered Al-Anon. And I also have to put a shout out. I'm a very deeply grateful member of the Al-Anon family groups.
Yes.
And I've got two regrets in 38 years of sobriety. Number one, I was about 6 days late in asking Adele Shea to marry me. And the second is that I didn't go to Al-Anon until I had about 15 years sober. And it's in Al-Anon that I found a compassion for myself that I have never found anyplace else. And I can never thank the women and men in Al-Anon that have helped me. And in my home, we have a group conscience that involves my wife, my cat, and me. They are always thrilled when I go to the Monday meeting in Sedona, Arizona. And so I just want to put a little shout out there for the family groups. And So I'm born into this family, and you know, the last thing I want to be is lame. And I find out that I'm able to do something really well, which is to metabolize beverage alcohol. I have an allergy. An allergy is an abnormal reaction to a substance. For example, by the time I'm 16 years old, my idea of a good time is to take a rack of Reds, high-powered Seconal, a sedative hypnotic, and wash it down with a quart of Spignata wine. Okay? Now, 90% of the population, if they do that behavior, they're going to end up in the hospital. What happens is synergistic effect. These two substances mix together, and people forget how to breathe. And they throw up and they choke on their own vomit. With me, I'm looking for car keys and to make short-term romantic commitments. Which brings me to a second point about this thing that I have, this alcoholism, which is that I have these blackouts. Now, if you've ever woken up with a life form with which you were unfamiliar when you left the house in the morning, you might want to take a look at your relationship with alcohol. And you know, I just came up with coping skills. You know, we didn't have the smartphone, so you'd put a piece of paper next to him and a pencil and say, "Can I please get your phone number?" You know, hopefully they'd write the name down. You know, and you know, occasionally there were guys that ended up in the bed, and it was the 70s, so it really didn't make any difference. You know, but anyway, it wasn't a lifestyle. It just stuff happens. You know. But people, I mean, like, you know, that whole thing about you wake up with somebody with a gender that you did not intend to end up with, you'd like maybe amend your behavior. Not me. You know, I just remember to drink a little more. So anyway, I don't understand that what I have is this allergy of the body and that I've got a phenomenon of craving. Now, the best way that I know to describe alcoholism is the Chinese proverb. The man takes a drink, then the drink takes a drink, and then the drink takes the man. And I had no idea that that's what happened to me. But by the time I'm 24 years old, with all of the, I mean, you know, I hit the lottery. I was born male, Caucasian, and Californian. And by the time I'm 24 years old, even though my family, for all their weirdness, they gave me the best that they had. They made sure that I was fed and that they gave me a love of books. They made sure that I got my homework done. And they introduced me to God as they understood God. And, you know, the best I could do with all of that is end up in Alcoholics Anonymous. Kind of awful. What happened is that I was arrested again, and I was sitting across from my father It was the third time in 9 weeks that I'd been arrested for driving under the influence. And I mean, and that was no big deal back in the day because they didn't have computers, right? You could hang all kinds of paper out there and it was no big deal. So I'm sitting across my dad having a vodka rocks and he looks at me and he says, "Do you think you have the disease?" And I went, "Well, I don't know." And he says, "Well, I got somebody that I want you to talk to." So I was out of options, so I said, "Sure." And so I called this guy up, and he said, "Meet me at the Howard Johnson's in Culver City tomorrow morning at 8 o'clock. Don't have anything to drink. And don't smoke any of that crap either." How did he know? So anyway, I show up, and this guy sits down, and he starts talking about his life, and he had problems in his life. And they kept growing, and he had problems in his life. And then he met Alcoholics Anonymous, and there weren't any problems anymore. And Alcoholics Anonymous, no problems anymore. Go on and on. He's talking for like 40 minutes, and I want to just shoot myself because I haven't had anything to drink yet. And he's not closing me, so I figure, oh, okay, I'll prompt him. So I say, "Do I need psychiatric treatment? Do I require religious salvation? How about hospitalization?" And this guy looked right through me and he said, "Listen, Trick." He said, "If you or your family can come up with the $3,000 that it's going to take to go to treatment," he said, "go out and drink that money up. And when you're done, call Alcoholics Anonymous. They do it for fun and for free." And, you know, and then he got up and he said, "If you want it, you're going to have to go after it the way you went after your booze and your drugs, punk." He said, "Look it up in the white pages of the phone book." And he left. He didn't take me by the hand and walk me into the halls of Alcoholics Anonymous and say, "Oh, here's a new man." He said, "Listen, punk, if you want it, go and find it." So I went home to my grandmother's house, because that's where you end up, right? And and I poured myself a water glass full of Daviess County old-fashioned Kentucky bourbon with 3 ice cubes, and I knocked it down, and I called Alcoholics Anonymous. And that was on the second day of 1979, and second day of May, and I vibrated into the meeting about a half hour late, because, you know, if they don't invite you to the pre-party, why should you show up on time? And so anyway, I vibrate into the Alano Club. Eunice was behind the bar, and she said, "You, upstairs." This was before newcomers had a union. And the union's called Cocaine Anonymous. But I judge no fellowship. but they went someplace where they were nice to them, you know? And so anyway, So I go vibrating up these stairs, and I go into, and everybody starts talking at me. Now I have no idea, why are they talking at me? Well, you can tell that I spend a lot of money getting my hair styled like every 6 months, and when my hair's long, I look like the Sphinx. And I've got the zup-zups going because I haven't had enough to drink yet, so I light a cigarette and it looks like a napalm strike's been called in. And the third guy that talked was a guy by the name of Butcher Joe. Joe Hacker. You can always tell Butcher Joe. And he looked right through me and he talked about how when the family left, he cried the big crocodile tears, and inside he's going, "Yes! Now we can drink and nobody's gonna get in our way." And I understood that. And then he talked about knowing just how deeply to cut himself so that they'd have to take him to the hospital and he could get the drink that he needed on the way. And he looked through me and he said, "You don't ever have to feel the way that you feel about yourself ever again." And that's why I'm here, to carry that message that you don't have to feel the way that you feel about yourself ever again. Now, if you're new, you don't ever have to withdraw again. This is the last time you have to. And for those of you that it's been a while since you kicked, maybe there's something else that's come across your bow, something else that you're powerless over. And I want to tell you from my personal experience that there are a variety of anonymous groups that have experience, strength, hope, and more importantly, a language of understanding that if you're getting your ass kicked by food or porn or tobacco, or we can increase the list ad infinitum, that there are people that understand and can help you. And it's an amazing thing. And for me, you know, going to Al-Anon fundamentally changed my life. Going to Debtors Anonymous to a meeting called Men and Money, because I'd never gotten any direction because I was raised by drunks. And I didn't even know how to ask the questions. And that help is available for you. And just an opinion. It's mine. It should be yours, because it's a really good one. I'll try and mark off the opinions at different times during the talk. So anyway, I'm in this meeting and a miracle happened. Four guys were going down to the Strand in Manhattan Beach to play poker and watch girls go by on roller skates. I was introduced to spirituality and Alcoholics Anonymous from the gate. It was incredible. And these guys invited the new man along for entertainment. And they said some really cruel things to me, like, "This is AA, kid. We don't use no dope here." I was horrified. But see, at that first meeting, I identified because people were talking about recovery from alcoholism. And I identified that I was alcoholic. And they told me that the front drink was what I had to stay away from. And if I was smoking a little medicinal marijuana, that I might want to cut the cotton mouth. And when I was being cute there, and I don't mean to be cute. If you're using plant medicine, it's a wonderful, wonderful thing. And there is stuff that is not psychotropically activating. And I've seen wonderful, wonderful recovery happen, and people get off years of opiate dependence by using plant medicine. So if you're using plant medicine, I'm not trying to shame you, but I am saying that there is stuff that doesn't affect you from the neck up, and it's a wonderful thing. But if I'm smoking marijuana, I'm not looking for the non-psychoactive, right? Just want to be clear about that. And if you meet my wife, she's psychoactive. The fabulous Adele Shea, who sends her greetings. But anyway, these guys say, you know, we don't smoke dope because sooner or later you're going to need to cut the cotton mouth, and Pepsi ain't going to get it. And if you're doing that Peruvian marching powder, you need a double Bombay on the rocks with a twist, just to take the edge off. That's not drinking, that's just taking the edge off, right? And if you've dropped a little LSD just to be spiritual, did you notice the new light fixtures they put in here? They're just like, you need about a gallon of Spignata wine just to settle you through the experience, right? They called that drinking. Who knew? So there was a guy, Danny T, who was at my first few meetings. He said, "We don't drink, we don't use, we don't go with girls who do." What an order. I can't go through with it. Took me a while to acquire a taste for the latter. But anyway, I mean, why would anybody date anyone that wasn't an allergic type? And why would anybody marry anybody that doesn't have a sponsor? I mean, you need some, I need the protection. My wife's got two sponsors. You know, it's difficult being with me. But anyway, so another thing about this, you know, these substances and all that stuff, to make it real simple for you, the difference between the alcoholic and the addict is their relationship with carpeting. Now, hear me out. An alcoholic, we've been out drinking for a few days, and we finally get indoors, and we're able to lie down, and it's soft. It's carpeting. Where for the drug addict, carpeting is a never-ending source of hope and imagination. If you wonder why these kids in the meetings are a little jumpy, you try smoking French fry bits and see what happens to you. So anyway, these guys terrify me, and I go home, and so I came in on a Wednesday and on Thursday, and then on Friday night, I go to the meetings, two meetings on Wednesday, because God hadn't created morning meetings yet. Meetings were at 12 and at 8:30, and that was it. Anything else was suspect. And then Friday, I go to the meeting, and then there was an Alcoholics Anonymous dance. And I walk into the dance, I vibrate in. Now my wardrobe at the time is I had a good t-shirt, a bad t-shirt, a pair of Levi's and some bowling shoes. I'm the reason you have to give them in order to get them, because I just boogied with the shoes. And you woke up barefoot one day in Santa Rosa. And there's these girls like last night, and like they'd had showers, and they're swinging their hips and they're snapping their fingers, and I'm 24 years old and I realize that I'm never going to get laid again in my life. So I go out to the Pinto, and I start driving towards the Stickenstein, not to drink, mind you. I just wanted to find a woman that understands. And on the way, the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened for me. This still small voice inside of me said, "This is not a good idea. Turn the car around." And I did. Every time that I'd heard that voice before, I had always just gone ahead and done whatever the hell it was that I wanted. And that day, I turned the car around. I went back to Larry Guerrero, and I said, "Hey, talk program to me, please." And he got me a copy of the big book because I had been too busy to get it. And, you know, I mean, I didn't want to look like I was coming home from Bible study. And he explained to me a little bit about the book, and I went home and I started to read it. And I got hooked in the doctor's opinion, where Silkwood talks about the sense of ease and comfort that comes from taking a few drinks. And I kept reading through it, and I didn't know what I was reading. Bill's story, and I wasn't interested in that world war or that stock market crash or any of that stuff. And I kept reading. At the end of We Agnostics, there's a story, and it's the story of Fitz Mayo, the third guy that came in New York, the preacher's son. And he said that he was really in a tough spot. Family hated him. He had PTSD, or they called it shell shock in those days. He'd lost all the money. The family hated him. His father had been a preacher, and his grandfather had been a preacher. And he knew what religious people were like. And he's sitting there, and he's withdrawn. And this voice comes to him, and it says, "Who are you to say that there is no God?" And he got down on his knees and said a prayer and had this big white light experience. And he never drank again. And I understood the story. So I got down on my knees and I said my prayer, and my prayer was this. I don't know the Talmud from the Torah. I don't know the Upanishads. I don't know the Old Testament. Please get me the top. I'll do whatever these dried up old geeks say to do. Please help me not to drink. And at the end of that moment, I submit to you that I had finished the first three steps of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. That prayer was perfect. I'm with you this morning. And so anyway, I go down to the Alano Club, and I'm stuck to the Naga Hyde couch, sweating, waiting for the meeting to start, smoking. And this woman comes in. She had a bun in her hair, black dress on. Looked like she'd been to Mass 852 times this month. She goes, oh, young man, you're new, aren't you? She said, I can tell you the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous in four words. What are they? Find God or die. Not that. Oh, God, not that. 38 years later, I can tell you the secret of Alcoholics Anonymous in four words. Find love and live. And when I say love, please don't hang on me what your definition of love is. I'm talking about an experience that I had in Alcoholics Anonymous. Dr. Bob said, we all know what love is, and we all know what service is. So find love and live. So this woman terrified me so much, I went into the noon meeting and I asked a guy to be my sponsor. Because obviously I was gonna need protection. And I'm an active AA guy. And I will never, ever be able to repay that man and his Al-Anon wife. He saved my life. He saved my life. I want to fall back just a second. That man that introduced me to Alcoholics Anonymous, the guy who told me to go find it in the white pages. Later on, I found that that man had 10 years sober, and that at another juncture, he had 15 years sober. And he was not an AA member when he got together with me. And he never was again for the rest of his life. And he saved my life. He's the one that got me to you. So remember, it's the message, it's not the messenger. So anyway, I got together with Mike, and I used to show up at his house. I knew that he was at work, and I'd be baffled about how not to drink. And I'd show up, and I'd be sitting on his porch when he got home from work. And his wife would come home a little bit early, and she was an active member in the Al-Anon family groups. And she would open the house and put on a cup of coffee and let me sit there and smoke until my sponsor got home. That is love. That is service. If it's not inconvenient, it's not love. If it's not inconvenient, it's not service. And are we the ones who are going the extra mile for the women and men that are coming to us today, or are we just hanging out seeing our friends? So anyway, I'm reading the book, Alcoholics Anonymous. You could read it unsupervised in the 70s. And I'm reading in chapter 5, and it says that if we don't do an inventory, we may not ever get over drinking. And So I ran to my sponsor. I said, I'm going to get drunk. And he said, what? I said, I haven't done an inventory yet. And he sat down and he gave me my my inventory guide, two pieces of paper with a line down the middle of it. He said, listen, kid, what I want you to do is I want you to go home, get really jacked up on coffee. It was before Starbucks, so it took a while to ramp up. And he said, what I want you to do is I want you to sit at the table, and I want you to look at the kitchen door, and I want you to think about every member of your family walking through there. And if your stomach goes like this, write their name down. He said, I want you to think about where you lived, where you went to school, you know, who you worked for, who you stole from. He said, and then write down the sexual weirdness. He said, we all have it. We're only impressed if an invertebrate is involved. So I went home. Now, you know, there's a lot of folks, you come around Alcoholics Anonymous and they go, oh, you're new. Welcome to AA. You don't ever have to drink again.
Watch out for the fourth step.
As if working the steps is painful. Painful is stealing from my grandmother. Painful is stealing from my daughter. Writing down who I hate? Please, you do that every night anyway. You just don't write it down. I mean, the program of Alcoholics Anonymous is designed for alcoholics. We're about that deep. Now, when I got done with that inventory,
was it a fearless and thorough moral inventory using all four columns?
No. It was the greatest hits. And that's what needs to be on that first inventory. To sit down and write about the stuff that goes around and around and around and around and around and around and around your mind. That's the stuff that we need to get out there. You don't have to, you know, if you've got deep dark secrets or, you know, your defects of character that you haven't been able to delve into yet, don't worry. They'll get in contact with you. And then you can address it when it comes up. But the idea is to get down and get to work. So I did my first inventory when I was 22 days sober. Did my four-step when I was 24 days sober. And at 28 days, the first guy asked me to sponsor him. And I called my sponsor. 28 days, I'm already out making amends. My sponsor made sure that I was a fully vested member of Alcoholics Anonymous immediately because I needed help. I didn't need understanding. I needed direction. And anyway, so I call him up and I go, this guy asked me to sponsor him. What do I do? And he says, Jay, you say yes. Really? He says, dude, if they're sick enough to ask you for help, you can't hurt them. And I wanna cap on what a couple of our friends have already said this weekend. There is a person who you are uniquely qualified to save. No one else can do it. And if you've done the work and you're available, you can do it. Because it's not about us. It's about whatever this power is. Or as I like to say nowadays, whatever this love is. Here's a little fun thing. A little new take on the Serenity Prayer. Love grants me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change. The courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. So anyway, I do this thing, and I start working with others, and I launch out into this thing that we call Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'm vibrating around in the pinot, going picking drunks up, just having a great time, smoking. And When I had about 6 months sober, and I don't talk about this except when I'm doing a Sunday morning thing, but I'm at the 2+2 church at the 2+2 meeting in Westwood, California. And I'm sitting there, and I'm listening to a woman by the name of Liz LaPresti, and she's talking. And she talked about how alcohol took from her everything that makes a human being, and reduced it to an animal. And as I'm listening and identifying with her, the room went white. And my first conscious thought was, maybe this is an LSD flashback. But I'd never had an LSD flashback. And what my heart said was, pay attention. And as I sat there, about 6 months sober, and what I was witness to was just light. And there was a feeling of everything is known, of all power, all omniscience, omnipresence, and omnipotence. And as I sat there, I came up with a question. It was about war. I said, what about war? And there was a feeling that came over me. It wasn't words exactly. And the feeling was, don't worry, I got it. And then I started to ask another question, and it was even louder. Don't worry, I got it. And as I sat there, I don't know, maybe it was 8 minutes, maybe it was 12, I don't know how long. The pitches weren't very long at this meeting, 15 minutes. And as the meeting started to wrap up, the room started to come back into view. And at the back of the pulpit in this church are three stained glass windows. God is love. And as I came into the room again and I looked around, it was obvious that no one else had been on the bus that I was on. And so I kept my mouth shut. And for the next few days, I went around and asked a couple of people, and I got various pieces of input. One guy threw a chair at me. AA was a little more demonstrative in those days. But then I went to my old parish priest, and he said, I wish that I had had a story like that. He says, but I've met four or five people of my parishioners over the years, and I know that what you said is exactly what they said, right along those lines. And I know that in a crowd like this, there's probably at least 50 or 60 people that have had the sudden variety. And then there's the educational variety. And sometimes there's a blending of both. And as we go along this path together, we have a variety of spiritual experiences. And there is no hierarchy in them. There is no hierarchy in them. And they're available for each and every one of us if we keep showing up at the meeting. But the thing that happened for me is that I was concerned, and I kept my mouth shut. And I didn't talk about this for almost 20 years, because when I did, it divided me from people. But I want you to know that these experiences are happening all the time. And you don't have to wait for that, because even with that gift, even with the steps, even with a sponsor, living as though, don't worry, I got it, is the operating principle in the universe. I still had the same difficulties that each and every one of you have had. But what Alcoholics Anonymous gives me is the ability to move forward in confidence and joy. And why is it that I got this Pete Carroll sobriety anyway? Why is it that I'm fired up about Alcoholics Anonymous more today than I was 6 weeks ago? It's because I live the dream. I live the dream. And each and every one of us has a design for dreaming that has been given to us. And all we have to do is show up and pay attention and go through this thing. Why I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is a more evolved spiritual practice than any practice that I've run across, and I've gotten to pray and meditate with all kinds of wonderful people, do great stuff, is because of the amends. Any other spiritual discipline that I'm aware of, they say, oh, don't do that. But they don't say, you got to make that right. And not only that, not only do we say, you got to make that right, but we say, we got to make that right. Because I may not know how to make amends to a mother that I haven't spoken to for 25 years. But my sponsor probably knows somebody that does. And they can share and guide me through the process. And this is the thing about AA. One of the fun things about Dr. Bob, you know? I mean, there are people that know that the person that gave the most for Alcoholics Anonymous was the person that Bob operated on that first morning. For those of you who haven't been heir to being historians, Bob was a proctologist, apt, and his sponsor gave him a goofball, which was a barbiturate and a bottle of beer to go into to do his surgery. Modern medicine at its finest. And so Bob goes in, and he's already demonstrated to Bill that he's just a flake, and so he drops him off, and he goes back to the house, and Bob doesn't show up after the surgery. Bill starts packing. Ann's crying. And at 9 o'clock at night, Bob shows up. Where the hell have you been? A little pre-Al-Anon. He said, I've been out mending fences. He was out, and he looked the people in the eye whose trust he'd violated, and said, what can I do to make it right? He never drank again. And, you know, I got into my amends really quickly because it really helps with the not drinking thing a lot. And just think about this. Look at all the folks that are here. Now, each and every one of us, in our heart of hearts, has probably got a resentment or a fear that we're dragging around with us today. What would happen to your home, your AA community, the town that you live in, this beautiful state of Oregon, if each and every one of us this week went out and made that amends? The amount of power that had been would be unleashed. Now, I had a grandmother, Alice. Alice had taught me how to tend bar, so I owed her just a little bit of money. And I went to her with a little money, and I said, Grandmother, I've stolen from you. Here's part of the money. God and AA are helping me to stay sober. Please help me, you know, and I'll be back with more. And she looked at me, and she grabbed the money, put it in her purse, and started moving towards the door. Where are you going? She said, I'm going down to the church. See, about 4 years ago, you told me that you didn't believe in God anymore. And so what I did is I went down to the church, and we put your name on a list, and me and the girls have been praying for you. And I need to go down and report that my grandson has been restored. Spiritual terrorism. It's highly effective. Now, society has changed an awful lot. When I first started working with others, almost every man that I worked with had some kind of religious training. And now, for the past 15 years, most of them have none. So how do you teach spiritual terrorism? Great question. I'll show you. When you come into a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, let me back up. 1985, my then wife Jacqueline got sober, an amazing occurrence in my life. When she got sober, we picked three people. Her best childhood friend, our friend Jeannie Playboy Bunny, many of you have probably heard her, and my sister Regina, who was missing in action with her self-employed Colombian boyfriend. We prayed for those three people at the end of every meeting that we went to. At the end of a year, all three of those people had picked up a desire chip. All three of them picked up a one-year cake. And the two that got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous are still consecutively sober. So this is what I'd like to invite you to do. When you go into a meeting, and we all know somebody that's really got a problem, when you walk in, just tap a chair and say the person's name. Get two or three of your friends to do it, and don't give up. And watch what happens. Watch what happens. Now, the stuff that I'm going to talk about now is, again, just like our steps. It's an experiment. Now, I'm not telling you what your results are going to be, but I'm going to suggest that there are certain things that you can do that can impact your life in ways that are beyond description. First is about our common welfare. I want to go on down a little wormhole here. Alcoholics Anonymous is the fifth largest publisher in the world, and the publishing industry has changed. And our funding is no longer going to be supported in the way that it has been by sales from the big book to cover the shortfalls of our individual donations. I went back and I checked. In 1979 dollar is worth $2.95. And I'm thinking, I'm going to two or three meetings a week nowadays, and I put a $5 bill in, and I'm thinking, you know, I'm doing my job. I was putting a buck in the basket at every meeting that I was going to when I was 60 days sober. And if I took a look at what that contribution was today, that 21 meetings a week would be $60. And I'm putting 15 in the basket for this life-giving thing that I've been. I'm not even supporting AA as much today, or I wasn't until, you know, and I'm not, if you got a couple years sober, I'm not speaking to you. But I'm talking about those of us who are responsible. Another thing is, truly, you know, and all you got to do is fold it into one and palm it into the thing. It's no big deal. But you start doing that, and you'll be amazed at how things catch fire in your groups. Another thing is, we got these smartphone things, right? When you're sponsoring somebody, you're talking to a new people, get them to download the book Alcoholics Anonymous from Alcoholics Anonymous World Services so that the funding goes into AA and not to somebody who's pirated a version. Grab the cell phone of everybody that you know that's 3 years sober and take a look in their books and make sure that they've got the AA. It costs you $35 to get the big book, the 12 and 12, as Bill sees it. Language of the heart. And you're supporting Alcoholics Anonymous. Another little thing. There's a shortfall that we have regularly, and it's been happening from the very gate. From the very gate, we haven't been taking care of ourselves. This is ridiculous nowadays. With the ability to directly donate to AA.org, anybody that's got a real job, sober a little while, 5, 7, 8 years, $100 a year to AAWS, 2% of the population AA does that, there is no shortfall. And do you know what we could do? we could do something that no generation of alcoholic has ever done. If we increase our contributions, we could make the Big Book available at cost. And Chuck C. and Norm Alpe and Bill and all those guys were never able to do it, but this generation of alcoholic can. And if we get responsible about that, by the time we get to Detroit, we could have a real celebration about what we've been able to accomplish in Alcoholics Anonymous. So just a little opinion. So the last thing, a couple things I want to talk about is, how do you live the dream? How do you live the dream? Well, the only thing that's been, you know, remarkable about my recovery is that I've always had a sponsor, I've always sponsored, and I've always gone to meetings. I have this wonderful AA life in Southern California. I'm going to all the right meetings. I'm sponsoring all the tremendous people. And I'm just having a great time, and I get invited to come out to a thing like this. And actually, it was much smaller. It was a gratitude dinner in Sedona. And I'd been going to Sedona for years and enjoyed it. You know, I mean, it's kind of a gulag where people like me end up. And so I go to this meeting and I give a talk, and they seem to have a good time, and I seem to have a good time. I got down, and on the way back to my chair to sit next to my wife, the voice said to me, "Move here. Now." Now, the reason that I meditate is to distinguish the voice from the voices. So I slide down next to my girl and I go, "Hey, baby, I just got told to move here." And she gives me this goofy grin and goes, "I got the same message this afternoon." And we went home to Los Angeles where we'd lived together. And I took a walk on the beach, and I realized that I'd had every wonderful experience a man could ever have in Los Angeles. And she was retired, and I was underemployed. And so we had three garage sales and threw our keys at a realtor and said, "Paint it vanilla and sell it." And we turned our car eastward for Sedona. Our friends thought a lunacy commission should be appointed. But then they heard, "Oh, Sedona, okay." So we get out there, and I'm there for a couple of weeks, and my wife goes to sell her house, operative term, her house, and there's a lien on it from a business thing that had gone south that I was regularly making amends on, and I had no idea that they'd put a lien on the house because I thought, since I'm in amends, I'm paying them off, and that was not the case. And this woman that I had been with, my muse, the person that wants better for me than I ever wanted for myself, said, "You know, you gotta go take care of this. We're done." And I end up back in Hermosa Beach at the Men's Stag, baffled. I got $500 in my pocket. I don't have any transportation. I got a 102-year-old grandmother that I'm responsible for. I'd been at this guy's house for about 5 days. I started looking for, you know, I'm looking for work on the internet, and all of a sudden there's a ad on Monster and on Craigslist that says, "Program director at a retreat house in Sedona." I felt like I'd been passed the dice. Anyway, so I call up and I get the interview, you know, and I borrow a car and I drive out there, and I'm just, you know, you can't pray for yourself. And I'm sitting there and I'm just baffled, because I really need to be present. And all of a sudden, this big heron comes and lands right in front of me, and it eyeballs me. And I knew right then that everything was okay. I may not get back with the girl, but I was good with that. I was good with that because I knew that if I'd blown it on this dimension, that I'd get to love her in another one. But anyway, the thing worked out, and I got this job where I'd organized and led retreats for over 20 years at this time, and I got this job, and now what do? I get to talk to spiritual whack jobs like myself, invite them to come to Sedona and put on their programs, and be with some of the most incredible transformational leaders that are running around the planet right now, because I was listening. See, there is a movement, a dance of the spirit within, and each and every one of us has the opportunity to get engaged with that spirit. And it's really, really simple. It's really, really simple. If you can do anything in the world, what would you do? We're sober. We can do anything. Anything. Find out what's in your heart and follow that. See, our lives have been saved not to be better consumers, but to live a dream. A dream that is uniquely you. No one else has that dream but you. And you get to live it. Now, what do you mean by that? Well, you know, with me, I wanted to help people learn to meditate. So I got together with a friend of mine and we developed a website called the numeral 3 minutes of silence.org. And there's a dozen different ways to meditate. Pray and meditate the way you drank and used. Just try shit. See where you end up. Tell you one little more story about that. A few weeks ago, I had the privilege of going to a peace and reconciliation conference for initiatives of change in India that is the modern-day iteration of the Oxford Group. And I've known these people and been involved with them for many years. And so I'm going, and I want to go down. I want to go see where Michael Jordan lived. With me, I want to go to Ramana Maharshi's ashram. And I took a look at the trip, and there's no way that I can do this. There's no way that I can do this. It's just too far. I can't get it done. But there's this little thing called Travelers in AA. And so I drop on a thing, hey, I'm coming to India. Where do I ought to go? And a woman that I'd been engaged, she'd been on two retreats that my wife and I had led in the Netherlands, says, hey, I'm down in Bangalore. Why don't you come down and hang out with me? And give a couple of history talks. Okay. She sent me a ticket. I said yes to double A. I get down there, we get done with the talk, I'm at this restaurant, I'm talking to this guy, I go, hey, you know, I'm gonna be in India for another week, and where can I go in order to have the ultimate spiritual experience? And he goes, oh, you gotta go to Ramana's ashram down to Arunachal. Well, yeah. I said, but it's way too far. I can't get that. He said, it's a 4-hour drive from here. And this woman had a driver in her car, and we were able the next day to go down. And I had the privilege of meditating in a cave that's been used for conscious contact for 5,000 years. Now, that's my dream. And I thought that I couldn't do it. And yet, that was the will of whatever for me. So I'd like to suggest that if you have the opportunity to really meditate upon what your dream is for 3 minutes each day from your heart. See, right now I've got this superhighway going from my heart down into my stomach, down into my gut, because I've got a connection with this power. And I've got, where did that connection come from? It came from reading the book. It came from turning the pages. It came from helping people walk through their fears and their confusion and their resentments. Dream deeply. And when you go to have your dream supported, please don't talk to anybody that's not following theirs. This is about growing along spiritual lines. It's not about being static. And along the lines, the things that I've gotten to do was, when I was just about 3 years sober, I quit using nicotine in any form whatsoever. Why? Because I've got a bad attitude and I didn't want people to tell me where it was. I could smoke or not smoke. Do it myself. And what my experience of that was, the reason that I don't use nicotine in any form whatsoever is because my feelings. I was able, more and more of my heart has been opened. When I quit, because I had cardiovascular disease, I had to change what I put in my mouth. And my heart, I had a heart attack, and my heart and my entire cardiovascular system has regenerated because I changed what I put in my mouth, and it's only plants now. And why do I do that? Why do I do that? Why do I stay with it? Because I don't feel better, because I feel better. No violence in my mouth, no violence in my heart. I'm on the path, I'm moving, I'm looking, I'm trying. I don't know what yours is, but don't just sit there. Move forward, live the dream, don't agree with it. If there's anything, any dream that I would have for you, please go to the meeting early and look for the woman or man who looks the way that you used to feel and say to them, how are you? I haven't had the privilege of going to a meeting with you today yet. What's up? And bring them along. You want purpose? I pray and meditate with all kinds of different folks and occasionally you run into people that say that Alcoholics Anonymous is a lower form of spirituality. If they say that, just agree with them and back up. Because they don't know and they don't need to know. But I tell you that this week you have the opportunity to go to the hospitals, to clothe the naked, to go to the jails. But what we do here is we raise the dead. You want a primary purpose? How about that?